You're listening to the Hello World podcast, number 90. My name is Sean Wildermuth, and I am your host. The Hello World podcast is where you can hear from some of your favorite developers, authors, and speakers about how they got started in this business and the decisions they made along the way. We go way back to their first computer, their first code experience, and their first job. With this episode, it only leaves 10 episodes left. Yes, we're ending the podcast after 100 episodes. The last episode will be Richard Campbell interviewing me about how I got started. Can't wait for you to hear it. We've decided not to have a sponsor for the podcast, but if you'd like to support the podcast and the other things that I do, feel free to visit my Pluralsight courses at seanw.me/psauthor, including my newest course on building a web app with ASP.NET Core 2, MVC, Entity Framework Core 2, Bootstrap, and Angular 4. I'd also like to share with you that I'm making a film. It's about software developers and why we do what we do. You can see more about that at helloworldfilm.com. Today's guest is Stuart Solare. Stuart is a principal software architect and developer, primarily on Microsoft technologies. He has worked in a wide variety of industries and problem domains as a consultant and employee, as well as teaching and mentoring. He's an 8-time recipient of the Microsoft MVP Award for work in services and integration, and was a Microsoft Regional Director for 5 years. Stuart is also a speaker at regional user groups. He co-directed the Portland Code Camp and co-chaired the Birds of a Feather track at 8 Microsoft conferences. Outside of software, Stuart is a member of the Oregon Mandolin Orchestra and teaches juggling at Reed College. Stuart is one of those guys that I seek out whenever I get to an event. I want to see if he's brought his mandolin and see if I can find a guitar somehow, because sitting down and playing music with him was always fun. But he's also got a great mind for software development. Today we're going to talk to him about how he got started. Let's take a listen. Well, I'm really excited to have Stuart Solare on the show today. We've known each other for a while now. I don't know if we ever met when we were back in Boston. Do you remember? I mean, Boston. When I was back in Portland. Do you know if we ever met back then?
I think we might have bumped into each other at like Padnug, the .NET user group here in town. But I think I first met you probably at either through activities up at Microsoft or maybe through our friend Chris Sells.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's when I found out what a great mandolin player you are.
You're making me blush. Thank you.
It's embarrassing to, you know, my little picking and grinning on my guitar, and then you doing all this amazing stuff in your mandolin. It's amazing to behold if you haven't seen Stuart play a little.
Thank you. Thank you.
So you're in Portland, where they now can pump their own gas, which I'm excited about.
In limited circumstances, in rural Oregon, you can pump your own gas. I know it's a risk we're willing to take.
So as you know, the show is all about how people got started in their careers. Did you have that, you know, canonical first computer when you were growing up, or how did that happen?
Well, I didn't have the computer. It was at Oregon State University, where my dad was a math student in a graduate program there. In the basement of that building, there was a PDP-8E, and we had access to it. My older brother, he's about 2 years older than I am, he got started in it and pretty quickly showed me you could write some instructions and make letters appear on the screen and bells ring, and you could punch paper tapes and pull off the back plane and take a look at the card that had 1K of handwoven core.
Wow.
And, you know, I wrote some simple programs. I got started in BASIC and a little bit of assembly language. moved over to, got a little bit of time on the mainframe that they had over there, which was a CDC 6600. So it was experiencing turnaround time, which is you brought your deck of cards, punch cards in, and there would be a sign on the wall that said when you could expect to come back and pick that up. And that was turnaround time. And, you know, I was writing, yeah, I wrote a little roulette program and so forth, but there were no personal computers in those days. I went to high school. I went to college. When I got to college, they had a PDP 1170. And so that was sort of the next time I really had a lot of access to a computer and taught myself a lot, learned from others. And after college is when the PC came into existence.
And the PDPs, were those multi-user machines or?
The 8E, no. It was a single-user computer. In the academic world, it was used a lot for statistical packages. Mm-hmm. And it was a teletype terminal with a paper tape reader on it. And then the front console had deck tape, which was about, I don't know, I think it was about an inch wide tape on a ceramic cylinder. And you could go over to the student bookstore and pick up one of those so that once you got your program entered, you could have it on tape.
But wow.
It was one chair in front of the console and you were in control.
And this was just a keyboard and a printer, right? There was no real screen to it.
There was a screen, and it was a dot affair, not a vector affair. And it, you had to do extra work to get it to print characters on that. Otherwise, it was a teletype with a really loud mechanism to strike the paper. And I think it even had settings so that you could get it to strike extra hard if you had carbon paper in there.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny. So did you, when you were working, using the computer at your dad's school, is that when you started to get the bug for programming or was that just,
It took me about an hour to get that bug. It's, you know, when I finally got characters to print on the teletype and be able to ring the bell and, you know, master a loop and just started to let my imagination go wild. I was, you know, as a young precocious kid, what was that, about 12 years old then. And, you know, my understanding of computers at that time was like Colossus, the Forbin project, right? It's like, we're gonna really, but that passion had to be, tempered with time for a while. I had in junior high and high school, my brother and I got some folks at the Xerox headquarters up in Bellevue to get us some time to teach ourselves and some friends BASIC and then Fortran. On a Friday afternoon, we'd get an hour in their office to work on programs and dial into a computer down there. But it was basically, you know, computers were hard to find and people were kind of, why would kids be playing on computers kind of thing.
Right.
Not a lot of parallels, but that was about the same time that Bill Gates was getting started dinking around on computers at educational institutions.
And the same thing, he had dial up access to a remote machine someplace where he started writing stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I got to college. Here is a timeshare system. And I couldn't believe, you know, people are just writing inefficient code because they don't have to pay for it. And, you know, all of the bits are spilling out on the floor. That took a little adjusting too, but I had a couple little projects, you know, working for professors doing simulations, doing some data analysis, and just kind of making myself busy on the computer. The college I went to, Reed College, they didn't at the time have a computer science program. And so I was in the math department, but I made a lot of use of the computer while I was there. Took a year off from college at one point and was doing some custom programming and also operations on some PDP 1170s up in Seattle, keeping myself off the streets. You know, go do the backup with the hard disk that looked like a washing machine. Yep. And learning how to boot the computer using rocker switches on the front and being able to do the, you know, octal conversion in your head and things like that. those were the heady days. And then I graduated from college and found myself a job with a startup company doing optical character recognition on the very first PCs that were out. In fact, we went, IBM Portland had no idea how to deliver a PC. They were still in the big iron business.
Yeah.
And, you know, we bought it through them and they said, well, it's here. We'll meet you on the loading dock. Okay.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah.
And so when you started at this first job out of college, were you the one guy in the office or was it a group of programmers or what did that look like?
It started out as me as the developer and the other guy was on the optics, on the hardware.
Oh, okay.
And there was a little bit of cross-pollination there. It was both of us. It was our first jobs out of college. And it was a startup company that had a 5-year run. So by the end, there had been probably, 20 software developers, probably half that number of people on the hardware side.
Sure. And, doing OCR back in the early days of the first PC, that had to be a pretty big challenge.
It was. We were early in that market, and that was good, and it was also our downfall, trying to define that market and such. But in terms of technology, though, when we got the original, you know, the first PCs that we got, we had the DOS reference manual, which included the assembly language for all of the calls so that you could figure out what was going on and what they were doing. And we were writing, I think Don Box has characterized this as the first component technology. So we were writing terminate and stay resident. Mm-hmm. Interrupt handlers, and we were taking over the keyboard interrupt because people don't press keys all that fast, so there's some time in between keystrokes to try and do some processing. And we had a handheld device, so it was natural that if you were scanning, you probably weren't also using a hand on the keyboard at the same time. Go ahead.
Were you, as you recognized a character, just, you know, doing the mimicking the key press to make it appear? Or
yeah, we were entering it just as if that key had been processed by the BIOS.
And do you think that you'd be happier right now if you're still doing assembly?
No. I think there's a lot to be gained from programming, like doing some real serious work in assembly and understanding how processors work. I've even had the situation where you're trying to find a bug and it turns out to be like maybe it's a bug in the compiler. And if you don't know some assembly and you can't read that and figure out what's going on, that would be significantly harder. You know, those were earlier days too. Compilers weren't as thoroughly tested and well designed, and but we were working with very limited resources and trying to do graphics processing and pattern recognition. So being relatively efficient in memory and with the CPU was a requirement. But I think you still get those kinds of things in embedded systems and smaller things like you might encounter more in the IoC world.
Sure. Sure.
I mean, excuse me, IoT world, Internet of Things. Okay. Get my TLAs.
Yes. I love TLAs. Were you someone that married yourself to certain languages? Like, did you stay in assembly a long time and were sort of reluctant to leave it? Or do you always view sort of the language as just the, you know, the way to interoperate with a system?
Well, I aspired to be more of a polyglot than I am. So my background is in mathematics, and so working in different languages feels very much like working in different kinds of systems, axiomatic systems. Different languages are designed to express different concepts. By really swimming in that language and understanding here's what it's really all about, even if you don't stay there, that's going to inform what you do with other languages. And so I learned a number of languages. These days I haven't branched out as much as I might want to. I'm still dying to spend some serious time in a declarative language. I kind of followed the path of where is there a need for expertise? I'm going there. So I learned C++ because I was in a consulting job and there wasn't a C++ guru. And I said, well, then there's an opportunity, and just immersed myself in the language and followed it through standardization. When C# came out, you know, beta 1, I was all over that, trying to, you know, understand the differences and the nuances, you know, kind of marrying the C++ and Java worlds. And so there's a bit of the love of the language there, as well as it's a tool for getting a job done.
Sure. When C# came out, I was very reluctant. I'd finally gotten comfortable enough with C++ that I really didn't want to give up the perceived power of using C++. It wasn't until I went to this course that sort of talked about why you should stop managing your own memory that the light all clicked on. But I think I'm one of those folks, or at least I was in the early part of my career, where once I got comfortable with something, I sort of dug my heels in about, changing to whatever the new thing is, no matter how much pain the current system was causing me.
Considering that I'm still programming in C#, I guess I fall into that camp too. I think the thing I felt most bittersweet about on that was the amount of time that I put into mastering COM and ATL. Yeah. And being able to consult for that. It's a lot of surface area. There's a lot of details to master. Different clients that I've consulted with would have vastly different, interesting problems to solve there. And setting all of that aside and starting anew in the .NET world was I guess as I said, bittersweet. My current job, I'm getting to do a little bit of that because it's a system that works with some legacy code that goes all the way back to C++ and COM. So far, I've been working mostly on the managed side, but there's a lot of interop there. It's just a legacy application, a big line of business app.
And so you talk about consulting and having clients and working with consulting companies. Where was that leap from, you know, sort of being a contributor at a company to whether you went to a consulting company or whether you went out on your own? Was that a leap of faith or was that just natural maturation in your career?
Well, I probably didn't appreciate how big a leap of faith it was at the time because I was still pretty, you know, young and flexible and agile in the responding to change kind of literal way. So I ran the course 5 years with the startup company. I took a little break, went, did some traveling, came back, and there was a fella at the Oregon Graduate Institute, which is part of the Oregon System of Higher Education here, who had transferred. He was a professor. He had transferred out from Carnegie Mellon, and he had a whole bunch of grad student projects for over the years, and he wanted those woven together so that he had something that he could use as a platform to write some grant proposals about. So that was kind of a natural fit. Come back, didn't have something lined up. Here's something that's got a research component to it and a systems design piece to it. And as that wound up, it was like, hey, let's find some more smaller projects where I can really apply my specialties as opposed to building a product. I think there's joy in both of those. But you're solving different kinds of problems and you're engaged with the other problem solvers in a kind of a different way. So most of my career has been consulting. I did 5 years doing online banking software, the company that Scott Hanselman was at.
Oh, okay.
I'm right now I'm with another product company and it's nice to be on that product arc and hear our releases and I'm seeing things through over a longer period of time. I like both worlds. I always caution people who want to go into consulting. It's a different mindset. It's a different approach. It's a different relationship to the technology and to the people you work with. If that's for you, that's great, but make that decision deliberately. I kind of fell into it and it worked really well for me, but it doesn't fit everybody's style.
Yeah. Well, I think that different developers are driven by different things. And I know a lot of developers, and it's certainly early in my career, this drove me, the idea of, you know, seeing something to completion and watching, getting the feedback from users and watching users actually, you know, benefit from the work you were doing, which is not what happens in consulting a whole lot.
Right.
At least my experience with consulting has been in that, you know, you sort of get the cart moving and at some point companies take over and you might not see the complete fruit of your work. That's not complete, you know, it's not 100% true, but it seemed to be more true than other cases. And because that part of the process really interests me, I found consulting sometimes a little empty because of that.
Yeah. And I agree. And it's what am I trading off for that? I'm getting into other problem domains, other business cultures, other technical problems, learning more about system design and architecture than I would working on a feature on a product. So, you know, there is a trade-off there. And So when you're missing one element of it, you can take solace in the other parts that maybe you wouldn't be exposed to in a product
oriented.
Yeah,
absolutely. So has your role changed over the years to be more of a mentor to other developers, or you're still an individual contributor, or what does that look like?
Well, I've been in the mentoring and sometimes training. I've written courseware for third-party companies, for Microsoft Learning, for Intel. So I've done a lot of things involving getting, you know, knowledge transfer, skills acquisition. I would include in that work that I've done helping get the Portland Code Camp started and running for, mm-hmm. I think we did it 6 years, 5 years, maybe. Speaking at user groups and so forth. All of that I'm passionate about because I know there were certain people along the way for me who gave me the hand up, that one crucial insight. And you never know when you're working with somebody what the one thing is that's really going to set them on fire. Don't underestimate the small things that we do for people. It doesn't have to be I taught this person the unified field theory and they went off and solved special and general relativity. It doesn't have to be on that level, but I feel like I owe something to bring the next generation, the next wave of developers along, not only as problem solvers, but as people who are passionate about it and, you know, going to be in it for that long haul.
That's interesting because I think you're right on track with not knowing what exactly going to, you know, drive people. One of the people that had the most impact on me was someone named Ron Rinaldi, who was early in my career. And it wasn't anything he said or did. It was that he took pride in really quality code, in really readable, clear, concise code. And wanting my code to look like that changed the way I developed more than, you know, any sit down or class probably could have, because right. I wanted to aspire to what came so naturally to him. Of course, he had been doing software for a long time. So, you know, I'm sure he didn't start out with perfect code either. And that's kind of the way this stuff builds up together, is that as a community, we make it, everybody better. I've had people who worked under me who improved what I did or even the coding I did. So it's not this, you know, it's not this hierarchy. It really is, you know, everybody makes everybody better.
Totally agree. And you know, when I go to a conference or a user group or watch a screencast, and yeah, the topic's interesting, that's why I'm watching it, and then somebody hits that one thing on the keyboard and you go, what was that? And so small things can have big consequences. So just knowing that in my life, wanting to create that opportunity to help contribute to other people's lives is a big thing that drives me in the mentoring space. You know, learning new technology is something I've practiced for a lot of years. So I think I've gotten pretty good at that. Here's a new beta, something, let's go figure it out. The docs aren't perfect, but we've kind of, you know, been down the road of having to read between the lines and ask questions and so forth.
Sure.
And that's not a skill that everybody can have. So if I can jump on that technology and then use that to accelerate other people, whether that's, you know, through the community or in my role within a company, then I'm offering something of value that maybe not everybody can do or likes to do.
Yeah. Or isn't afraid to do, which is sometimes also the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Learn to fail. Well, you mentioned mandolin playing. Another thing I do is I juggle and I teach juggling. And basically, if you're not dropping, you're not learning. Mm-hmm. And I try and bring that to the technical world, too. You need to have an environment where you're allowed to do some experimentation. And some of those experiments are going to end up on the cutting room floor.
Yeah.
But they're learning experiences and you want to have that experience.
Yeah. The Doug Ware, who is a guy here in Atlanta, I don't know if you've met him before, but he likes to say, you know, my job is to fail. If I, you know, succeeded in everything I do, then, you know, why am I building systems? If every moment of this didn't compile, or I'm going to scrap this whole idea and start over, is because I've learned something and I want to, you know, do it better.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think we can get caught up. I think developers, I don't know if it's developers in general, or I'm expanding on my own insecurities, but I think there is this piece of like wanting to show that you know what you're doing so much that we're afraid to show other people that we don't know things. And it took me probably 10 years before it was actually Chris Sells. I heard him, we were talking about something and was something he had written a book on, and I asked him a question. He went, I don't know, let's find out. And I had this moment of, wait, not only don't you know, but you're willing to admit it. This is a pretty pivotal moment where I finally got it, that I didn't have to constantly be proving myself.
Right. And I think that constantly proving yourself can be intimidating, and that exclude certain people who are maybe on our teams who aren't vocal in meetings. They're not contributing in a community kind of way. They're sure. Quietly struggling to try and prove themselves and be at that level. And, that they perceive their heroes to be at. And, and it works a lot better, and you get a lot more involvement when you can include those people by not making it a competition.
Yeah.
Who can write the most perfect code?
Right.
There's something about, you know, there's definitely, like you were referring to earlier, there is something about having pride in the code you write, but maybe that's because I had to write it 3 times to get something that looks this good.
Yeah.
You can kind of get there by saying every time I pick up a piece of code, I'm going to make it better. You know, if I'm taking an example, let's say Stack Overflow or something like that, I'm going to think critically about that. And does that really fit this problem? Can I make it better for the people who are going to be consuming it in this system?
Yeah.
And by having that, I'm going to understand it well enough to make it a little better. I think that says as well, hey, I've got people on my team who are writing code that's good enough. Let's help them make it better, as opposed to the criticizing you got it wrong. So that it's a more welcoming, less competitive environment. And that's, we struggle with that. You know, I don't think education's not set up that way. Often teams are competitive and people are competing for raises. They're competing for recognition from their boss. They're competing for respect from their teammates. And that's, you know, that's institutional. I've had the good fortune of being consulting, at least on some projects where there's a different culture and they're trying different ways. And I think that takes some deliberate, let's dismantle the natural competitive place that we all go to. And then you find that, you know, welcoming inclusivity, I got it, turns out to have all kinds of rewards, right? So,
The collaborative versus the competitive,
right?
You know, yeah. Atmosphere, you know, changes a lot of things. Your work with the Code Camp and user groups and stuff in Portland always impressed me, because it was there is this sense in sort of community, software communities, that once you can see other people and see them, you know, one of the things I've always encouraged people to do is just go talk. If you want to go do a talk, don't like try to write a course. Go and like, we had this problem, and these are the four things that we did wrong, and then we finally did it right. And that's a way better talk than trying to go, the basics of C# are, you know, especially for your first few talks.
Right. Right. And make it real. Tell a story.
Yeah.
Because people will retain that. That gives them a framework to hang those key nuggets of information that you're about to impart, and make them memorable.
In a lot of my talks, I do live coding, and what I really like to see is when I make a mistake, and you can kind of see the audience go, "Wait, this isn't so, you know, perfectly polished that he's not afraid to make a mistake," because I don't freak out. I'm like, "Oh no, I got the demo." You know, it's none of that. It's like, "Oh well, let's fix it, or maybe we can learn from it." I think the more that we as developers, not just speakers or any of that stuff, but developers are willing to show, you know, that in between the meetings where we're talking about what good we're doing, that we're all struggling with that, you know, that sort of batter mentality. Oh, I succeeded 30% of the time. That's, you know, incredible. That's incredible. You know, average. It's not like a football team where you need to go 16-0. It's more like a batter where if I succeed 25 or 30% of the time, I'm ecstatic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I concur.
Yeah, I think failure drives that. So one of the questions I like to ask to sort of wrap up the interview is, are there any, you know, opportunities or things you thought you would have done that you regret in your career? There paths that you didn't take or did take that you regret?
Wow. You know, I think they're all kind of small minutiae, you know, little, wouldn't it be nice to have, you know, gotten more experience by now, at least with, you know, a declarative language. Mm-hmm. There were certainly projects that I've been on that went, you know, a little bit long. you're waiting to move on. We're just solving memory leaks with, you know, Beasters and ad ref and release counts. done that, solved that problem over and over and over again. I guess I'm fortunate. I really love the work that I do, and I've gotten to improve myself in directions that further my career just by me picking up a book or attending a course or, you know, these days watching a screencast or something like that. And that has created so many opportunities that I've been able to capitalize on, or at least just play with some code at home and have some fun, that it's hard for me to say, oh, you know, I missed that one, you know, chance to work with bots or
sure,
streaming video, or, you know, there's so much great technology out there, and so much of it scratches my intellectual itch that that I do consider myself pretty darn fortunate. So hard to say, boy, I missed the train on one specific thing. Yeah.
Sure. And I get that. I'm always impressed when someone, you know, says, no, I don't think I regret anything because, I second guess myself a lot. So sometimes it's nice to be reassured. I'm not the only one. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. This has been absolutely great. And now I have to go find a picture of a PDP-8E.
I can send you one. Yeah.
I might. We just shot at the computer museum in Seattle, and I shot a few PDPs, but I think only 9s and 11s, if I remember right. So right. We'll see how that is. Well, you have a great day in Portland and enjoy the rain, as I guess you have to enjoy it at some point.
I love it. I do.
We will talk soon. Thanks again. All right.
Hey, good talking with you again.
Thanks for listening to the Hello World Podcast. Remember, you can subscribe to the Hello World Podcast at hwpod.com.